Okay. Well, we're continuing our overview of the wisdom literature until Alan returns to start the quarter off in the book of Ephesians. And as I mentioned last week, I often like to begin a class with a quote that I think has reference to the subject. So this is, quote, the line I'm interested in is the fourth line, but this comes from an unfinished epic poem by the 18th century painter and poet William Blake. The poem is called The Four Zoas, which in my research on the poem, it's believed to refer to the four seasons of life and the struggle humanity has endured after the fall of man. Blake was a mystic poet that had something of a Christian worldview. What is the price of experience? Do men buy it for a song or wisdom for a dance in the street? No, it is bought with the price of all that a man hath, his house, his wife, his children. This is the line that's of interest to me. Wisdom is sold in the desolate market where none come to buy, and in the withered field where the farmer plows for bread in vain. So, in the 18th century, as in the ancient Near East, wisdom was not valued very highly. Men preferred to live by their own wits.
Classicism.
Yeah, there was that. But it cost mankind everything when he chooses to live by his own wisdom rather than the wisdom of God. The first three lines remind me of a modern-day proverb. It's probably been said a number of ways, but one way I've heard it is, experience is a hard taskmaster, but a fool will learn from no other. So that's today's quote. Wisdom sold in the desolate market where none come to buy. Bible scholars like to analyze and dice everything up until its smallest components. And one of the ways they have chosen to analyze wisdom literature is by breaking it into two distinct types or genres. The first they call didactic wisdom. And by that they mean a practical kind of teaching that's meant to address morality, personal success and well-being. And that type of wisdom is found pretty much exclusively in the book of Proverbs. The Proverbs are full, and we're going to look at Proverbs this morning, but the Proverbs are full of this didactic form of wisdom. The book of Proverbs is, generally speaking, optimistic in its character, especially compared to Job and Ecclesiastes, which are the other type. And we'll talk about this more in a minute, but the Proverbs tend to promote the retribution principle, which we've talked about a little bit last week, and we're going to go into some more detail in just a minute. The second type of wisdom literature, come on in, is sometimes called speculative wisdom, philosophical wisdom. And in contrast to Proverbs, it's a little darker. In fact, it's a lot darker. And it's one reason why some people do not like speculative wisdom books, like the book of Job and especially the book of Ecclesiastes, which we'll look at next week. The speculative wisdom is more uncertain in its conclusions. It faces deeper issues than may necessarily be faced in the didactic wisdom. And it comes across as pessimistic, and it repudiates the retribution principle. And so the two wisdom books that fall under that are Job and Ecclesiastes. I don't know how to classify Song of Solomon. That book is totally different. I suppose, if anything, I would call it didactic. All wisdom literature is meant to teach, so it's not a question of one teaches and one doesn't teach. But the didactic is more practical, down-to-earth, everyday kind of teaching. Okay, let's talk about the retribution principle. It goes by a number of names. But the retribution principle, simply stated, is this: that God always blesses the righteous and always punishes the wicked. There's a one-to-one correspondence between, if you're blessed, it's because you're righteous. If you're suffering, it's because you're wicked. If a person's suffering, it's because of his own wicked actions. And an extension of the retribution principle is, the greater the blessings, the greater your personal righteousness, and the greater the suffering, the worse the sin that you've committed. So we see that very active in the book of Job, of course. Job is very blessed at first, and he's an extremely righteous man, seemingly the most righteous man on the face of the planet. And that's no surprise that he's blessed, in his friend's thinking, because he's so righteous. But when things go south, they conclude that it must be because of sins he's committed. And because his life is so terrible, he must have some hidden sin that's particularly grotesque. Of course, he knows that's not true, and he can't understand why he's suffering, because he also believes in the retribution principle. It was commonly believed throughout the ancient Near East, and is still believed in our own day. It was commonly believed in Jesus's day. I can think of two examples where Jesus pushes back against the retribution principle. Can you think of two examples?
The blind man.
What about where the...
And where the wall fell.
Yeah.
The Tower of Siloam?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, so you have this situation where Jesus, and I think that's in Luke 13, Jesus uses two examples. There are martyrs whose blood is mixed with the sacrifices, like Herod. And then you have this tower that fell. I think 18 people died. I don't remember the exact number. And Jesus said, were these people more wicked than others because this disaster befell upon them? And it's a rhetorical question. The answer is no, they weren't more wicked. They suffered for reasons that had nothing to do with them. Which, there's multiple examples, but there's one more in particular I'm thinking of where Jesus deals with this. But instead of from the negative side, he deals from the positive side.
What about when he gave the Phoenician woman? He included the Phoenician woman in the blessings that were reserved for their children.
Okay. That's true. That's not what I'm thinking. You have to, you know how it is. Teachers always want you to think what they're thinking.
Yeah. Okay, well, we won't go there.
The example I was thinking of is when the disciples asking, was this man born blind because of his sin or his parents?
Yeah, so that's an example. That's another one I didn't think of, but that's an example of equating suffering with sin. How about an example Jesus gives equating blessing with righteousness? And he rejects that. I'll give you a hint. It has to do with a camel going through the eye of a needle.
Or more, a rich man doesn't have a chance.
Right. And how Jesus said how hard it is for the rich to enter the kingdom of heaven. And how did the disciples react? They're shocked, aren't they? They're like,
who can be saved, didn't they?
That's right. We've always considered these people the super righteous. Of course, Jesus knows better. Okay, so let's go on. That's so The books of Job and Ecclesiastes will push back a little bit against this idea that you are invariably blessed if you're righteous and you invariably suffer in this life promptly if you're wicked. People, and we know this, people suffer for reasons beyond their control. Of course, we do suffer for things that we do. But people don't always suffer for things that there's injustices built into any system that can cause people to suffer through no fault of their own.
Yeah, one of the points I made in the Job class is we live in a world where we suffer because of other people's sins.
Exactly. Exactly. So, if we're friends, Job's friends, we have to be a little bit careful about when a person's suffering, necessarily attributing to their own failings. Now, all of us, the wisdom literature is clear that God does discipline those he loves. So, we always have to take a look at ourselves when things happen and ask, you know, is this something God's trying to teach me? But we have to be a little careful about always assuming that, particularly for other people. Okay. Okay, I only have one slide about Job, because I know you've covered it thoroughly, but I'll just say this. There are several key ideas in Job, but God's justice cannot be reduced to a simple application of the retribution principle. Job suffers for reasons that he does not even know, and it wasn't because of his personal sin. The end of the book of Job teaches us this: God's wisdom is key to acknowledging his justice. We don't have enough information to judge God's justice. We infer it from his wisdom. And by the wisdom in the book of Job, he points out to the creation. The creation, and we're going to see this in the book of Ecclesiastes. Creation indicates God's wisdom, but it's something that human beings do not have enough information to fully understand. And so we're not in a position to judge God. Okay. Let's jump on to Proverbs. There was a clock on here, but I can't see it with my glasses off. So there's a number of ideas in the book of Proverbs. I just picked three things. We'll see more as we go through the book. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. And we're going to see some elements that make up the fear of the Lord. But without God-centered understanding, there is no wisdom. And that's something we're going to learn from Proverbs. The way of wisdom leads to life, wholeness, and well-being. And this third point, when I've taught Proverbs before, has sometimes been a controversial point amongst some people. But I believe that the Proverbs present a general principle of what one might expect, but they are not an absolute guarantee that whatever is said will absolutely happen.
Yeah, most people that hold that view are young.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And inexperienced.
I held that view for a number of years, but you do run into
reality.
And when you compare, and part of my reason for looking at the wisdom literature as a whole is you kind of need to read Proverbs in light of Job and Ecclesiastes, and you need to read Job and Ecclesiastes in light of Proverbs. If you just read Proverbs, you might think that every proverb is an absolute guarantee from God that nothing bad will ever happen to you and you will always be blessed. So they're good advice, they're a general principle. I believe they're inspired by the Holy Spirit, but they're meant to give general principles and not absolutes. The book of Proverbs is a very difficult book to outline because there are multiple authors and there are many, many themes in the book of Proverbs. But one way I've chosen to break it down is just to look at how it breaks itself down. It's a collection, and whoever compiled the book of Proverbs in each section talked about who wrote that section. So we begin with these Proverbs of Solomon. And then we're going to get some more Proverbs of Solomon. It'll tell us, you know, these are Proverbs of Solomon. And then there'll be a section that's anonymous. It's just the words of the wise. We don't know necessarily where those individual Proverbs came from. And then there's another section that's further sayings of the wise. Again, anonymous collection. And then we have the third section of Proverbs of Solomon. And then we have one chapter that has the wisdom of Agur, or however you say his name. And the very last chapter, 31, is the wisdom of King Lemuel as taught to him by his mother. So I guess we could say the author was King Lemuel's mother. And that, of course, has the famous virtuous woman section. That's kind of an epilogue to the whole section in the whole book. Any questions or comments so far? Yes,
sir? Do we know who King Lemuel was?
I don't.
I don't either.
I looked him up, and I did not find who he was in a very brief look.
Does the book say who Agur was?
No.
It doesn't tell him either, right?
No. Presumably he's a wise man, or somebody that was considered a wise man. But
that's the focus, not on the man, but
right,
on his wisdom.
Right. The focus of all of them really isn't upon who the author was. Mm-hmm. Although it's interesting to me that the last chapter basically comes from Lemuel's mother, and the first section that we're going to look at in a minute is a father and a mother giving advice to their son. Okay. We're not going to have time to break down the Proverbs, of course, 31 chapters in one day. We're going to look at the first parts a little bit. So if somebody will read, go ahead and open the Proverbs if you have a Bible with you. And if I can get somebody to read the first seven verses, what I call the preamble to the whole book. Just anybody.
You may read it.
Sure, anybody.
The Proverbs of Solomon, son of David, king of Israel, for attaining wisdom and discipline, for understanding words of insight, for acquiring a disciplined and prudent life, doing what is right and just and fair, for giving prudence to the what simple, knowledge and discretion to the young. Let the wise listen and add to their learning. Let the discerning get guidance. For understanding proverbs and parables, the sayings and riddles of the wise. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of knowledge, but fools despise wisdom and discipline.
Okay, so that's kind of bookends one side of the book of Proverbs, and it tells you what it's about. The author, at this section anyway, is Solomon, and its purpose is to teach righteousness, justice, integrity. And the audience names three people: the young, the simple, and even the wise have something to learn from the book. Now, what does he mean by simple? Today, simple would be a derogatory term meaning a lack of intelligence or cognitive abilities. But it's a term used throughout Proverbs, and it seems to mean somebody that's naive, gullible, easily influenced. It's not that they lack mental acuity, but they lack judgment, experience in life, and so forth. So when we read simple, is there another translation that somebody else has that has a different word than the simple? Just out of curiosity. The RSV used the word simple.
Mine says the Hebrew word rendered simple in Proverbs denotes a person who is gullible, without moral direction and inclined to evil.
Okay, so that's sort of similar. A person that's gullible, naive.
Something like a shallow.
We've all known people that desperately follow the crowd, right? You know, everybody's parent has told them, you know, if your friends jump off a cliff, are you going to? Well, yeah, they would. That's the simple. So the wisdom is meant to try to educate the simple and turn them from their simple ways to a wiser way. And the same with the young and even the wise. So the foundation of wisdom is the fear of the Lord. We're going to encounter some of what that means as we work through some Proverbs and Ecclesiastes as well. Okay. We'll look at the prologue in a little bit of detail. Boy, it's rather warm in here, isn't it? Last week you could hang meat, and this week I'm not complaining. But I didn't bring my jacket to wipe my face. So the next 9 chapters are going to be instructions of a father and a mother to their son. And there's going to be a number of instructions and warnings. But the big two are what I'm calling here easy money and easy sex, and particularly the second. It also talks about the great value of wisdom, and it contrasts wisdom with folly. And it begins an analogy where wisdom is personified as a woman speaking at the street level, trying to warn the simple and the young against folly. And in this section, there's what seems to me to be 10 lessons. And nearly every lesson begins something like this: hear my child. And then the lesson will proceed. One of them doesn't do that, but almost all of them is an instruction from a parent to a child or a young person. I'm saying a child. It's really, as we can see the subject matter, it's really more a young man than it is a child. So the first one is avoiding easy money. That is money gained by violence against somebody else. So if I can get somebody to read verses 8 through 19... Anybody
that wants to.
Proverbs chapter 1, verses 8 through 19. Good.
I have a King James version.
That'll be good.
The New King James.
Oh, wow. We don't want that old King James.
My son, hear the instruction of your father, and do not forsake the law of your mother, for they will be a graceful ornament on your head and chains about your neck. My son, if sinners entice you, do not consent. If they say, come with us, let us lie in wait to shed blood. Let us lurk secretly for the innocent without cause. Let us swallow them alive like Sheol, and whole like those who go down to the pit. We shall find all kinds of precious possessions. We shall fill our houses with spoil. Cast in your lot among us. Let us all have one purse. My son, do not walk in the way with them. Keep your foot from their path, for their feet run to evil, and they make haste to shed blood. Surely in vain the net is spread in the sight of any bird, but they lie in wait for their own blood. They lurk secretly for their own lives. So are the ways of everyone who is greedy for gain. It takes away the life of its owners.
So this is the first of what will be many warnings of casting your lot with violent men. There's a little bit of an interlude where wisdom is personified. I won't read the whole thing. I'll just read a couple verses. Wisdom cries out in the street. In the squares, she raises her voice. At the busiest corner, she cries out. At the entrance of the city gate, she speaks. How long, O simple ones, will you love being simple? How long will scoffers delight in their scoffing and fools hate knowledge? And she goes on to give further warnings to the simple and the evil. So that's the first lesson.
These are some lessons that, if you ever read a Dickens novel, they're just personified in the Dickens novels of the youth who's led astray. They're quite.
I didn't know that. So it was a lot of his novels are moral lessons. Mm-hmm. In 19th century Britain, as it's becoming industrialized, then I guess it's been a problem for a long time.
Yeah.
It's certainly a problem. You know, you see this in inner city gangs and so forth. That for a certain person, there's an attraction to violence and to stealing, easy money, right?
Yeah, right.
I've always made a connection on 20 there, cries aloud in the street. It's there in, but people just ignore it. They don't.
Right.
They don't pursue it.
Wisdom is trying to pursue the simple, but the simple don't listen.
Won't have any of it.
They won't have it. It's sold in the desolate market where none come to buy.
I love that verse.
Okay, there's great value in wisdom. The second lesson. And wisdom is found in the Lord. Wisdom, part of its value is it serves as a protection and a shield against evil and the results of living an evil life. Wisdom prevents a person from going down a certain path that's destructive ultimately. And then we get this first, what I call the first warning against adultery. I think there's going to be four or five in the book of Proverbs. But this is the first. I'm just going to read just a little bit of it. This is what wisdom will prevent you from. You will be saved from the loose woman, from the adulteress with her smooth words, who forsakes the partner of her youth and forgets her sacred covenant. For her way leads down to death, and her path to the shades. Those who go to her never come back, nor do they regain the paths of life. The book of Proverbs has come under some criticism in modern day because it's believed that women are portrayed in a bad light, because there's frequent warnings against an adulteress. And I guess I kind of see a little bit why they might say that, but I think it equally points to a problem that a lot of men have. It's as much a critique of men, if not more a critique of men than it is of women. It's men that have this problem that they have to be warned about. They can't give in to their urges, I think. And we're going to see that that's one of the most prominent themes in the book of Proverbs for young men is avoid illicit sexual relationships. Third lesson starts in chapter 3. Wisdom can produce a long and productive life. That's one of the benefits of wisdom. Then there are some commandments. Be loyal and faithful. Look at verses 3 and 4, chapter 3. Do not let loyalty and faithfulness forsake you. Bind them around your neck. Write them on the tablet of your heart, so you will find favor and good repute in the sight of God and of people. So the loyalty can apply in a lot of situations, but again, it might apply loyalty to one's spouse. And so it might be a somewhat hidden warning against adultery as well. Trust in God rather than human wisdom. Trust in the Lord with all your heart and do not rely on your own insight. In all your ways, acknowledge him and he will make straight your path. Do not be wise in your own eyes. Fear the Lord and turn away from evil. So part of fearing the Lord is being righteous rather than wicked. There's different aspects to what the fear of the Lord involves, and we're going to see later in this book and then in Ecclesiastes some examples of what fearing the Lord looks like. Honor God in stewardship. We've been talking about stewardship all summer, and it looks like we're going to be talking about it all fall as well in the other room, and I guess even in the sermon. Honor the Lord with your substance and with the first fruits of all your produce. So in the Jewish covenant, they would have had a tithe of the first fruits. Then your barns will be filled with plenty and your vats will be bursting with wine. And then the final piece of this one is recognize God's discipline. So there are troubles that may come from God as a way to teach his people. So there is a little bit of defense for the retribution principle there.
King James word, chastening.
Yeah, that's a great word.
There's chastening for the person who does not listen.
Yeah, that's not a word we use anymore, is it? Chasten or chastening? Yeah. Too bad, it's a great word.
Yeah. And then part of one of it is chastise. So chastise, I used to teach my students words that they didn't know, and they looked like they didn't know the word chastise. And one day I had to really lay it on the line about an assignment we were doing and how they weren't doing it.
Mm.
And I said, now you can say you have been chastised.
So they understood it then.
Yeah. If you demonstrate it, they understand it.
Good. They've probably never forgotten that lesson. They may not do their work, but they know what the word means. Fourth lesson in this first section. There's great value and blessings in wisdom. There's a lot of repetition in the book of Proverbs, so we'll see some of the same themes come up over and over again. Let's look at this chapter 3, verse 19-20. The Lord by wisdom founded the earth. By understanding he established the heavens. By his knowledge the deeps broke open, and the clouds dropped down the dew. Does that remind you of anything from the book of Job?
The questions that God
poses at the end of the book, right? His response to Job is, you know, where were you when I made the world? You know, what do you know about these great monsters of the deep? Of course, Job doesn't know anything. He was chastised.
Yeah.
And chastened. And he owned up to it. He didn't make excuses. You're right. I don't know. I don't know anything. Okay. Let's see. Where are we? We're in the fifth lesson. What I call a family heritage of wisdom. Solomon. This reminds me of something Southerners, I understand, used to say to their children. Remember who you are.
Yes.
Solomon says, remember who you are, in our vernacular, beginning in chapter 4. Listen, children, to a father's instruction and be attentive. For I give you good precepts. When I was a son with my father, and my mother's favorite, he taught me and said, let your whole... So this is a family tradition, a family heritage of wisdom that a father passed to a son, and now that son is passing to his son.
And in a Southern heritage, how often did I hear, what would your grandmother think?
Yes.
Don't you know what your dad always said? And don't you know what we've always done in this
family? And it had great power, did it not?
Yeah.
It had... for many people, more power than anything else.
And it was a great security.
Yes. You know. And unfortunately, it seems to have little power.
It's not that
today.
Much today.
Yes, it would be interesting to know why sociologically that has broken down. But in any case, remember who you are. In this case, the wisdom passed down through the family. Sixth lesson, avoid wickedness. Okay, we're not going to cover every one of these because we don't have time and there's a lot of repetition. Stay on the path of righteousness, the seventh lesson. I'll just look at this very briefly. My children, be attentive to my child, be attentive to my words, incline your ear to my saying. Do you see how all these, almost all these lessons begin with my child? It's like I'm starting a new lesson. Listen in. Or at least that's how I'm breaking the book down. Incline your ear to my sayings, for they are life to those that find them. Keep your heart with all vigilance. Put away from you crooked speech and put devious talk from you. So this is kind of a new theme, which is there's a contrast between true speaking and lying. And it's very important in the wisdom literature to speak the truth and not to lie.
What was that last verse?
That I just read aloud?
Yeah, I wanted to make note of that.
20? If anyone knows who Ben Carson is, and I'm sure a lot of people in this room do, I got a letter from his wife telling me his birthday was coming up, and she wanted me to fill out this card for him, you know. And she said that he reads the book of Proverbs daily.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
He said he reads part of it before he ever gets out of bed in the morning.
He seems like a wise guy, so yeah. That, yes,
wise
ma'am.
Guy.
I don't mean wise guy in a bad, I mean, he's not a wise guy.
The Italians out of the family, I'm a wise guy.
He's not a wise guy. He's a man of, he seems like he's a man of wisdom.
Yes.
An unusual level of wisdom for.
He's a very calm person.
Yes.
Strange.
Yes, ma'am.
I administered to women in addiction.
Okay.
And something I would have them do, because I did, was for spiritual discipline, have them read 5 psalms a day, but 1 proverb.
And one chapter or one
chapter, because they're each month, because there's 31.
Yes, yes, because it works out that way, yes.
And so that, you know, that...
Yeah, that sounds like a good practice, yeah, yeah. Yes, ma'am.
I suggested one time, I usually give the graduates a little something each year, and I suggested... along with my little gift, that they read a chapter in Proverbs every day, and most of the time you know, 31 days.
Yes.
But, and then it continued throughout the year. And
yes.
And you would learn from it.
Yeah, that would be a great
practice. As a
young
person.
Yes.
I don't know that any of them did it, but I suggested it.
Well, see which ones of them turned out wise, and you'll have an idea.
Well, and I did it because I suggested that they do it.
Mm. Do you find it helpful?
Sure.
Yeah. Sir, let me try to get back to what you asked.
Just Proverbs 4:20-24.
Okay.
I don't know.
Okay, so the next lesson, lesson 8, is another warning against adultery. When we repeat these, I'm not going to go back through them, but you can look at them. But the 9th lesson has some financial advice. Guarantee a loan for?
Oh, yes. Who you lend money to.
Be very careful who you guarantee a loan for. That's basically what he says at the beginning.
I had a lot of young engineers work for me, and invariably they would get entangled with a woman they were living with by co-signing on a loan for a car, and then breaking up, and they got the responsibility for paying for the car.
They ignored two proverbs. maybe not a married woman like what Proverbs continually warns against, but they were in an illicit sexual relationship, number one. Number two, they got into a financial entanglement that ended up costing them a great deal.
They were downright dumb.
Yes. They were
simple, right?
They were simple, right? They were easily influenced by their culture. And didn't,
oh, and by their partner.
And their partner. But I mean, the culture is, yes, you know, this is okay. And so you do it. And then their partner then, whether it was a man or a woman, either one can make that mistake. And then here you go. Okay. There's also a warning about sloth. That's another word we don't use much anymore. But laziness. Be busy and productive. Okay, the 10th and final lesson in this section of this prologue. Two more warnings against adultery. Okay, we go through the next couple chapters are going to have this rather long interlude where wisdom is again personified and invites the simple to a banquet, a great feast that wisdom provides to the wise. We're going to skip that because time is starting to run short.
Which is a contrast to that in one of the warnings of adultery.
Exactly right.
Yeah.
Exactly right. One of the temptations of the adulteress is she's going
to
invite you into this feast.
To her house.
Yes.
And have a big feast.
Right. You'll have this bacchanalia.
Yes.
Another word. You probably didn't teach that to your high school
student.
Yeah,
I covered that one when I did mythology.
Yeah. But wisdom is going to offer a greater feast, and it's going to be a much greater feast.
Much more substance.
Yes.
Because a simple man, what does bacchanalia mean?
She's going to invite you into feasting and drinking, and then, it's going to lead to an orgy.
And what the picture is you get is that it's very delusional.
Right.
And it's just an illusion of really having fun and having a feast.
It seems like a good idea at the time.
Yeah.
Oh, we're
and, and then the next morning you wake up and you're hungover and it was a really bad idea.
That's something to do with the god of wine, right?
Right. Bacchus
was
the god of wine. So bacchanalia is an adjective, or bacchanalian is an adjective anyway.
Well, bacchanalia,
that's
a
noun, right? Yeah, that's the event. Where the god of wine,
yes,
he's busy. Okay, so this is going to be a great feast. Again, this is another of the wonders, the advantages of wisdom. But now it's not personified, but it's presented as a feast. Okay. There's another warning about adultery in chapter 9. Young men, youth is wasted on the young. Okay, that was the first section. I'm going to have to speed up. But now there's going to be two separate sections. Again, it's going to be Solomon, but now things are going to change a little bit. The structure, it's not necessarily written to a son. Now these are more general. And this is going to run from chapters 10 to chapter 22. And as far as the form, these proverbs in this section are mostly what scholars call antithetical couplets. That is, there are two lines, and the second line contrasts with the first line. We're going to look at some examples of this. So it's a form of Hebrew poetry called antithetical parallelism. I thought about doing a poetry, because I'm just kind of fascinated with Hebrew poetry in this series, but I've decided not.
We did talk about it.
Yeah, and you've talked about it, I'm sure. Ed talked about it. I've talked about it when I've taught. So, but it's something we kind of need to remind ourselves, I think, because we're not familiar with poetry that works by, even though poetry in English works this way, too, we're not used to balancing thoughts. We're more used to balancing
rhythms. Except in the 18th century, Pope has a good many epigrams.
Yes.
And they're that antithetical nature.
Right.
Like one of them is, be not the first by whom the new is tried, nor the last to lay the old aside.
Yeah, so that's an antithetical couplet. He was probably extremely familiar with the Proverbs, like most educated people of the day would have been. So what does this section talk about? Well, they're comparisons. Wisdom versus folly. Righteousness versus wickedness. Wealth versus poverty. Work versus sloth. Speaking the truth versus lying. Love versus hatred. Anger versus humility and calmness. That kind of thing. Let's just look at a couple of them. Somebody will read chapter 10, verse 2.
Ill-gotten treasures are of no value, but righteousness delivers from death.
Okay. See that there's two lines, and they are opposites or contrast one with another. How about verse 5?
He who gathers in summer is a wise son. He who sleeps in harvest is a son who causes shame.
There you go. That's sloth versus industry. The lazy child sleeps in when there's work to be done. The wise child does the work.
Yeah. What's that proverb about the a little something, a little folding of the hands, and you'll wind up begging for bread or something.
Yeah, that is a proverb.
Yeah.
That is a proverb. A little sleep, a little folding of the hands.
Poverty comes on right. Like a bandit.
There's lots of these proverbs. A sluggard turns on his bed like a door swings on its hinges. That's a proverb from the
book. Laura and I will remember, I read the book of Proverbs with her and her brother when they were probably 8 or 9. And one day I picked them up and for some reason, doing some jobs came up. And I said, well, you ought to do those jobs, you know. I said, laziness is a sin. What? They just were astounded. And they said, that's a pretty hard way to put it, Grandma. I said, well, that's pretty much the truth. You know.
Yeah.
Shirking your duty. You remember that?
A little bit.
I think you called you a sloth.
You chastened them.
Sometimes. Most times I took them to Chick-fil-A and bought them snacks and
Okay.
At least, I don't know, maybe that's why they came.
That's rewarding, Jason.
Yeah.
Sorry, didn't mean
yeah. to. Yeah, there's probably a proverb about that, taking your grandchildren to Chick-fil-A, but I'm not familiar with it.
Yes.
There actually is some wisdom in Ecclesiastes that I probably won't do, but next week it extols the virtues of a bribe.
Yes.
So you've taken that one to heart. Okay. We're not going to cover all these, but let me just look at one more. I'll just read verse 19. When words are many, transgression is not lacking, but the prudent are restrained in speech. So, with a lot of talking, it's easy to sin. All right. Let me skip to the next one. We're going to have to speed up here a little bit. So, then there's another collection of Solomon. Again, it'll... The second collection of Solomon changes its form somewhat from antithetical couplets to what are called synthetic couplets or synthetic parallelism. And the way this works is instead of a simple contrast between the second line and the first line, the second line presents more information. It emphasizes the first line by telling you a little bit more. And it's going to have similar themes as what we saw in that first set, except there's going to be more talk about the king, what the king needs to do, and a subject's relationship to the king. So let's see how a synthetic would work. The fear of the Lord, this is 15:33. The fear of the Lord is instruction in wisdom, and humility goes before honor. So it adds to the fear of the Lord the idea of humility. That's an additional piece of information you didn't get from that first line. Um, 16 verse 5, all those who are arrogant are an abomination to the Lord. Be assured they will not go unpunished. As an abomination, you learn that they will be punished. So that's some additional information that you didn't necessarily know from the first line. Okay, so that's the Proverbs of Solomon, part two. Sayings of the wise. These are these. This starts in chapter 22, and these are anonymous. So in 22 verse 17, it starts the words of the wise. And so there are going to be all kinds of topics that are covered here. And they'll use that parallelism that's found in other Hebrew poetry, but they also start using poems that are multiple lines long, not just two lines. So that example of that is verse 22 in chapter 22. Do not rob the poor because they are poor, or crush the afflicted at the gate. For the Lord pleads their cause and despoils of life those who despoil them. So that's four lines long. Verses 1-3. When you sit down to eat with a ruler, observe carefully what is before you and put a knife to your throat if you have a big appetite. Do not desire the ruler's delicacies, for they are deceptive food. I'm not sure what kind of a moral admonition that is, but it's good practical advice. Don't pig out at the king's banquet. Okay. almost out of time, so I am going to so there's another section, this would be the third section of Solomon, where he has more about the role of rulers. He has a lot to say about how we should treat the poor. And he has, and I'm not going to have time to look at this, but what are called proverb poems, which are longer sections. Agur, it's just one chapter. Agur likes numerical riddles. There are three things that a Lord hates, a four that he despises. You know, that kind of thing. Let's just look very quickly at a numerical riddle. Look at verse 7 through 9. Two things I ask of you. Do not deny them to me before I die. Remove far from me falsehood and lying. Give me neither poverty nor riches. Feed me with the food I need, or I shall be full and deny you and say, who is the Lord? Or I shall be poor and steal and profane the name of the Lord. The leech has two daughters. Give, give, they cry. Three things are never satisfied. Four never say enough. Okay, so he likes numerical riddles. And then the last one, I think we're, for most of us, are really familiar with Proverbs 31, so I won't say much about it, but that's the famous, the words of King Lemuel, an oracle that his mother taught him. Any final comments, questions about Proverbs?
Where is that? I was thinking we're about to come to it, and probably we just didn't cover it. Where that section where the drinks are described, how they sparkle in the
yeah,
cup.
Yeah, how they sparkle in the
yeah,
cup.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't always, know. I didn't bother to cover that.
I think that's a thing with kids.
Yeah.
You know, because the opportunities are to drink and
yes.
And to drug and everything. But
right.
Anyway, it just talks about how enticing it is.
Yes.
How pretty it is in the glass.
Oh, yeah. Looks pretty good. It's kind of like the feast that the adulterous woman.
Well, that's one we can look up this week. But I recommend it particularly with, it's a picture. It's a picture, and kids
right.
can get pictures.
Yes.
Well, it starts off with how the drink looks great, but then it tells what happens afterwards.
Right.
Like you're on a ship, and it's the mast of a ship, and somebody very close to me who used to drink told me that's exactly how you feel in the morning.
It wasn't me.
Proverbs
23:31.
It wasn't
Proverbs 23:31.